Blog Talk Radio.
Life seems to crush your dreams, so find your balance for all your needs. A little work, some family fun. Find your love, keep your life on the run. Told you how the story goes, so write your own script before you grow old. Live your life, laugh out loud. Own who you are, stand up proud. You got
Good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast. It is our 400th episode tonight. That's right. Tonight is a milestone night for the Star Chamber Show. Episode number 400 is in motion right now. And I am broadcasting you live out of a very, very chilly part of central Kentucky. I know some areas of the north have it a bit worse than we do, but it's still under 10 degrees here. It's probably about 6 degrees outside right now, and it's a bit chilly, so I hope everyone's got their hot chocolate or other beverage of choice that might help them to get warm, because it's definitely a chilly night all across the United States, I know for sure. And but joining me tonight is the wonderful, the vivacious, the loquacious, and of course the wonderful Holly Phillippe. And I think she's actually on here. Hold on, let's see if her mic comes on. There you are.
I am
Holly.
Here. I am. Hello, hello.
You are. You know who was first first into the chat room for episode number 400? It was Tommy B. Smith. Isn't that cool? How cool. He is on it. Yeah. And I got to give him yet another recognition. Thank you in just a moment. Of course, we're going to give you a little rundown of some of the Imaginarium news, because that's what this podcast is affiliated with, the Imaginarium Convention. And, of course, we always want to keep you up to date on all the latest happenings with the convention. And there always are, because it's a 7-day-a-week task year-round now. And that's not even kidding, but we had a spotlighted guest. Two spotlighted guests. We had three new panelists, and we had a new sponsor come aboard since last week. And for our spotlighted guests that have just been added, we have award-winning author and screenwriter Sheldon Higdon, and he is a writer, has an MFA from Seton Hill University, member of the Horror Writers Association, and the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. He's super, super talented. His work has been featured in nearly 50 publications, and currently he has a short screenplay being produced as a film in London. Yes, that's London, England, because we do have a London, Kentucky, believe it or not. So, yeah, I might as well specify, since I am broadcasting out of Kentucky. That is the London of England, yes. Then we also have cosplayer and podcaster and definite Imaginarium favorite, John Peacock. And John is awesome. I mean, many of you have met him. I know we've had him on the show before. He is a founding member of the Western Kentucky Ghostbusters, and he's a member of a lot of cosplay groups and also part of the Cosplay for a Cause Foundation, a great charity organization that uses cosplay to raise money for a lot of wonderful things. And then also he's a member of the Ohio River Valley Cosplayers, abbreviated ORCs. And he's also the host of Nerd Alert, which is a pop culture geek news podcast, part of the Nerdy Talk Nerdy to Me podcast network. Great, great guy. Love having him at the convention. And, yes, John Peacock is coming back. So yes, a person coming for the first time, Sheldon Higdon and John Peacock, who has been there before. So, yes, we're always introducing new faces and bringing back familiar faces. So, yeah, it's a nice balance so far. And then as far as panelists go, we have two new faces and one familiar face added. As far as first attendees of Imaginarium as panelists, we have Jake Clark, who is an artist, graphic designer, and book cover artist. Guy is super, super talented. Get a chance, go to his site. We've got links on his guest page on our site, for Imaginarium, but you can go check out his work. Super talented cover artist, and definitely going to be great. He's going to be giving some great critique workshops. So yeah, you can bring covers and have them critiqued by him. He's a super, super talented designer, but he's given some pair of great workshops that are coming into Imaginarium. Then we also have author, podcaster, poet, and expressive art facilitator, Lisa M. Miller. Really excited to have her. We did announce a workshop by her last week on the show. And then also now we announced a panel being moderated by and a workshop by Alan Goldstein, who will be returning, author and journalist, Alan Goldstein. So really excited to have Alan. Of course, he has one of the best author photos in history with a mountain lion looking over his shoulder. So, yes, he's got a kitty. And, yeah, we have, I'll mention something about a kitty here in a minute because we got some updates from our personal life, too. But, hey, Tommy, hang on for that one. You're going to like it. Then we also added J. Caleb Design as an official sponsor. And, yes, J. Caleb Design has created more than 1,000 covers and counting, and the proprietor of J. Caleb Design is the Jake Clark that I mentioned just now, and his work is uses 3D modeling software, digital painting, and a host of other software assets, and he creates fully custom in scale and everything with his work. Just fantastic guy, and I can give you the URL. I've got that right here. For J. Caleb Design, it's jcalebdesign.com. So, yeah, check them out. Really super, super good cover art artist and a new sponsor of Imaginarium. Welcome aboard. Welcome aboard. And so, yeah, our personal life. Yes, we have something exciting to share with you. We're going to get an official photo probably tomorrow because the poor little fellow has had to wear a little cone on his head after having to get a little medical work done. But we have a new member of our family, Holly and I do. His name is Leon, and he is a, guess what, a tuxedo cat. So we have three now. We have three kitties, and, yeah, it's been quite the week, Holly and I.
Have that way.
It wasn't planned that way. It was just how it worked out, and it's odd because he happens to be about the same age as Victoria and Albert. He looks like them. He just fits in like a glove with them.
Like,
and we had to, of course, you know, because he hadn't had any kind of medical anything, so we had to check him out, and we couldn't introduce him to Victoria and Albert just yet because of possible FIV and all that other stuff. We're glad to tell you he has a clean bill of health on that front. Did not have FIV when they tested him, so we're going to be able to introduce him to the other two kitties tomorrow. But yeah, we've had it hit right when Kentucky got, you know, snow and ice and 3-degree weather. So yeah, we had to go all about in this muck
and the poor
vehicles.
He's been inside and outside, obviously. He was my daughter Diana's kitty, and she's working a crazy shift and just can't, you know, take care of him like she was. And so
or she wasn't.
Had to take him in. But we have taken him in, and, you know, it's cat haven here, so he's going to be well babied, and there's a house full of older grandkids that are just, you know, excited for him to come out of these little room, because we had to put him in the downstairs bathroom for now, but, you know, so we don't want to cross contaminate anything. So why he's being treated and tested for stuff. But yeah, tomorrow is the big day, and I've known Leon for years. He's my big boy. He's always been a sweetheart to me, and so I can't wait for him to meet Vicky now. But I don't know how Queen Victoria is going to take it, that she's, you know, rules the roost, but I know him and Albert.
It'll work out.
Buddies.
Yeah, he's got a real, real laid-back kind of personality. I bonded with him really quickly. He's, you can even hold him upside down in your arms like a baby. Yeah, he's totally.
Like a baby.
You can rock him like
he's
a baby.
It's
awesome. Yeah, and he's a decent size. He's not quite as big as Albert. He's just a little bit smaller than Albert, but he's close. He's close. So those two brothers are, you know, be like the brother lions, hopefully. And you know, of course, Vicky is the the unpredictable one. So this should be interesting.
Yeah,
we're gonna have to watch this close.
Yeah.
So But she's curious, and I think it'll work out just fine. And I'm happy because Leon finally has a home where he'll actually get taken care of. We'll actually get treated right. And, yes, it's – ha, yes. that's all I'll say. But I'm really, really happy about that. And yeah, he's definitely a welcome addition. And it's just a coincidence that the name Leon also is a derivative. It means lion. So, hey, that's another bonus point. So that's cool. And yet, etymology of that name. So how cool is that?
The vet thinks it's hilarious that we've ended up with three tuxedos and none of it was planned. I mean, they've all come to us.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much fell into our laps. And so here we are with three tuxedos.
Yep. And don't you worry, Tommy. We will get you a photo of Leon, because I know Tommy loves this, I'm sure. He thinks this is probably a cool surprise. So, yes, we got a good chat room hopping tonight. Definitely have any trouble logging in. Refresh, and it looks like everyone's got their avatars back, mostly. I only see one that doesn't. But, yes, we have everyone from Amy McCorkle to Kenzie Michaels to Moon, Dwan L. Hearn, and Sandy Lender, the genre blender, and, of course, Tommy B. Smith. And looked like we had a Jack Forsyth in there. Nice group. Really excited. And, yeah, definitely going to be a good conversation tonight. Before I go to the folks that brought you tonight's show, I do have one personal update. Yes, yesterday my novel, brand-new novel, Hellscapes, came out. And, yes, 344 pages, tour de force of macabre, very visceral, very intensive horror. And yes, it is very different from, you know, the dark, some of the fantasy and sword and sorcery and YA dystopian and contemporary fantasy that I do. So it is, a different aspect of my work. So, just know that, you know, it does fit in with the things like Clive Barker or Wayne Barlow. It's very visceral, very macabre, but it is in my Hellscapes universe standalone novel. And definitely want to thank Tommy B. Smith for suggesting and encouraging me to do a full Hellscapes novel after three volumes of Hellscapes short stories. And definitely, I loved the process. It was intense. Took me down a lot of roads, the themes, definitely things that I think are important that are in it. But it's definitely a very, it's got Lovecraftian elements. Of course, I mentioned Wayne Barlow and Clive Barker influences of mine. It's got that kind of Dante's Inferno thing where, there's an undercurrent to it. It's not just shock value kind of stuff. There's, things are meant to be where they are. And it's an intense one. So, yeah, if you want to go and take that road with me, please do pick up a new copy. It's in print and ebook. And if you don't read horror, gift a friend. Help me get this book off the ground. To gift a friend of yours that likes horror, because you can do that with ebooks and print, but off Amazon. So, but yeah, I'm really excited about it. Holly, can make a comment or two, and then we'll recognize the folks that gave you tonight's show. But anything to say about the book, Holly, before we do that?
Well, all thanks to Tommy B. Smith for putting the idea out there years ago. Tommy's like, hey, Stephen, have you ever thought about doing a full-length novel, for your Hellscapes? And then it was born. The idea was Planet. Stephen ran with it. The cover art, just phenomenal.
Graham Ganson. Graham.
Oh, it's a phenomenal job. Hand-drawn, and then he digitized it. It was very cool. And I got Steve a shirt with the cover on it for Christmas that he wears often now.
Yep, long sleeve hoodie with the cover. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It is. It's so cool. The book itself is, very macabre, very visceral, very, if you like horror and you like paybacks, then read this, it all ties in and you see parallels to today's society, today's world, and the state it's in. So it's quite interesting. There's a lot of elements to it. a lot of very cool creatures.
Oh, yes.
Paranormal creatures, I should say. Very cool creatures. unlike, you know, what you've ever written before, actually, these are like your creatures and your other hellscapes on steroids. So, yeah. Yeah. It's cool. It's a fun one.
All right.
It's hard to put down. Once people get started, they're not going to want to put it down. So be warned.
Be warned. Well, looks like our guest is going to be on deck here in a second. So we're going to go ahead and recognize the folks that brought you tonight's show. And then we are going to bring on tonight's guest, who's going to be fantastic. Really looking forward to this conversation. So bringing you tonight's show is the wonderful Sandy Lender, the Genre Blender, and those fine folks at Per Bostet Publications. So first I'll give you a little bit from Sandy, and then we'll recognize Per Bostet, and then we will get into tonight's conversation. Here's Sandy.
Hey, Star Chamber listeners. Did you know that author Sandy Lender has a BookTube channel on YouTube? She is using the platform to talk about books and stories and indie authors and new characters you might not have heard of before. And she's doing it all with a positive spin. Check out Sandy Lender at Sandy Says Read on YouTube for all the creative, bookish goodness.
Yes, and it only takes you a few seconds, and it's free. So while you're listening to the show tonight, go over to YouTube and get on Sandy Lender's channel. Click subscribe and definitely click that notifications button as well so you don't miss all of her great content there. Come on, folks. You can do it. You can do it. So thank you, Sandy. And now we'll go over to Per Bostet. Per Bostet Publications is a small press based in the Louisville metro area, specializing in speculative fiction and other outside-the-box books. 40 titles in print and ebook formats and a handful of audiobooks, Per Bostet offers a little bit of everything. Follow the investigations of Private Eye David Blaze and M.B. Dabney's An Untidy Affair, a historical mystery set during the 1985 police bombing of the Move House in Philadelphia. Or join the psychic private investigator Alan Rodriguez in New Mexico in A Handful of Dirt by Janie Franz as he tries to clear an elderly man wrongfully accused of murder. You can find these titles more at PerBostetPublications.com at Amazon, or you can find the press in person at In Conjunction in Indianapolis and Louisville's Imaginarium Convention in July and Prime Crime in Indianapolis in October. Per Bostet Publications, where timeless tales unfold. So thank you very much, Teely Harris, Sarah Marion, and Marion Allen, the literary triumvirate, as I love to call them. So yes, we're going to go right into tonight's guest, and so I'm going to go right into the introduction, and then we will turn the mic on and welcome her to the show. But yes, tonight's guest was born and raised in West Virginia, spent most of her adulthood in Europe before settling in Virginia, and earned a Ph.D. as a highly successful biology teacher. She won state, national, international recognition until Parkinson's disease impaired the use of her dominant right hand, forcing her to retire. Her switch from being right-handed to left-handed accompanied a passage from sciences to art, kindled drawing and writing pursuits, and led to the Crypsis Royal Blue and the Prism Codex 3 novels. And now she has a new novel, which is nonfiction in nature, The Violent Years, which is about her father's experiences as a soldier in Germany during World War II. He was captured and escaped and then returned to his home to become a U.S. Olympic gymnast. So, yes, it's exciting, exciting tonight. We are bringing aboard for the very first time, welcoming onto the show and hopefully the first of many visits, author Barbara Wood. And, Barbara, your microphone is on. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. There's Holly. Yeah,
yes.
Always been looking forward
been
to having you.
Forward.
Yes, and I have.
Yeah,
I'm
looking forward to hearing all about your whole story. The whole story is fascinating, but your novel about your father, that it's just incredible. His story is just incredible, and I can't wait for you to share with our audience, our listeners, and our chat room, you know, all about it and where to get it and all that good stuff. But
yeah.
But we'll first start off with how long were you a writer? When did you start writing?
I didn't start writing until a few years ago after I retired. And it was just kind of by accident that I did. I just had this thought and I started writing it down. Before I knew it, I was writing a book. I didn't really expect to do it at the very beginning. And then I was just having so much fun, I just kept going. But this particular book, the new one, the fiction one, was came from a totally different area. Apparently, in 1983, I had asked my father to record the events of his life, and he actually did it in 1989, and he made a series of 14 tapes, 8 of which covered the decade 1940 to 1950. And he called those years the violent years, not because people were being hurt or anything, but because of the tremendous changes that were occurring, both good and bad, in his life. But I didn't hear the tapes then, because I was busy raising a family and starting working and all those kinds of things. I found the tapes. Actually, my son found the tapes in a closet just a couple years ago. And, of course, by then the technology was really old, and we couldn't listen to them. But my son said, I'll figure out how to change them over to digital, which he did. And when he handed them to me for Christmas 2 years ago, he said, you really need to listen to these. These are very unusual tapes. And so I sat down and listened to them, and they formed the basis for the book. Actually, half of the book are the transcripts from these tapes. The chapters are actually his words. And then it alternates with other chapters about the rest of his life. And I actually had two storylines going here. One of them of what was going on in his life, and then I alternated chapters that are a third-person narrative explaining the background behind his life when he was growing up. And I had to do that because these tapes are directed to me. He addressed them to me. And as he's speaking, he's not explaining a lot of things like certain people and where locations and so on. And a reader would need to know that information. And so I developed this backstory that was going along at the same time. And I used the other tapes, conversations with my mother, who is still alive, and also there were 400 pages of love letters that survived from them, and they formed the basis for this backstory that's driving along at the same time. So I get two stories for one in this book.
Wow.
That is so cool. So how did he go from being out? My curious, I know you don't want to give too many spoilers, but how in the world did he escape? I mean, was he a pilot? What did he do in the military?
Oh, he was just an infantry soldier, just trudging along, marching through the mud like a bunch of other guys. He said he felt like a cog in this huge mammoth war machine, walking behind the guy in front of him, until one day, of course, the guy in front of him was shot in the head and died right in front of him. The book opens with him landing at D-Day. He's in the second wave of D-Day, and that's where the book starts. And his descriptions of it, he doesn't really describe the battle so much as he describes what he is seeing and what he is feeling, what he's reacting to. And, of course, there are the scenes where he's running around in Europe for a while and has several things that happen to him, and then he gets captured. And he goes to two different prisoner of war camps, and finally he has a chance to escape. And the story for that is quite remarkable. And through the whole thing, the reason he survived, I think, a lot of the times, was because two things. His attitude was very good, where other guys were saying to him, you know, why are you trying to learn these extra little things? What difference does it make? We're all going to die. And his reaction was, maybe there'd be one thing, one little thing that I could do that would make a difference. And it turned out there were a bunch of those things that he learned or done when he was a child growing up, little things that he had learned or tried to do. He picked up a few words of German, for instance. And, of course, he was an athlete. He'd been very good at tumbling and gymnastics from the time he was very little. And he used to practice it with his buddies. They would go to the movies, and they'd come out, and they would have they would reenact scenes from the G-Men movies or from the cowboy shows that they were watching. And they pretend to have guns. They would shoot each other, bang, bang, you're dead, and they would fall down steps, and they would tumble. My father said he would tumble. He didn't mean, well, I'll just kind of stumble. No, he's actually doing flips and handsprings and so on downstairs and everything to get away during these scenes that they'd recreate in the movie theaters at the end of the movies. So when in the wartime, when he says, I dove down and tumbled down the steps to get away from the shots that are being fired, he's actually tumbling gymnastically down the steps.
Wow. Yeah. That's yes, yeah, so probably, you know, some of that, you know, may have contributed to him surviving, as you said. And
right.
I'm interested, yeah, because as far as the lessons that he brought back with him that helped him become a U.S. gymnast, I mean, obviously he had, you know, some of the background already as an athlete, but I'm sure that, you know, things that, you know, experiences through the war and all helped him to become what he became after the war, too, I imagine. Would that be right to say that?
Of course, yeah, that would be true as well. They interact and make the person, the whole person, think. It gives him a lot of grounding as far as where he's going with his life and what he wants to do. And one of the things that I was kind of shocked to realize at the end is that he met my mother when he was 16 and she was 14. And of course, they're separated by college first and then the war. And then there was the gymnastics things going on all the time. And when they finally get married, you realize she's just 20 and he's 22. All of those things happened before he was 22 years old. And that's something that most people today cannot imagine, having gone through all of that. So he was ready to settle down at 22 because all that had already happened.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, not that, you know, it's likely that your father would know my granduncle, but he was in a combat engineer, and he was also on the D-Day landings and had some, you know, just amazing stories about, you know, surviving the first night on the beach and, you know, it was pitch black and you could hear, you know, German soldiers talking and they didn't have control of the beach the first night. And he was talking all about that. And then later he was in the Battle of the Bulge as well. And, yeah, I mean, those are just stories that you know, so many experience that, you know, but so many, you know, have not told those stories. And I commend you for picking that up and deciding to tell your father's story, because there's so much to those stories that, you know, doesn't get out and doesn't get turned into a book. And I think it's amazing that, yeah, after writing some novels that, yeah, you turn to nonfiction and wrote, you know, your father's story. How is the, and how is the novel structured? How does it read in terms of the writing in it? I'm curious.
Well, I've structured it, like I said, the two storylines. So one is simply the transcripts from him. Now, of course, mm-hmm. he speaks in a very folksy way, which is very pleasant and easy to listen to. Put it down on paper looks terrible. So I had to clean up some of that a little bit, but I try to keep as much of his folksy language as possible in there because he speaks very clearly and he's very organized when he's talking. So I'll have a chapter of him speaking and then be a chapter where it actually reads very much like a novel because there's a lot of dialogue and such, but they are stories from his other tapes or that I've known about from him personally or my mother was telling me because she's still alive. My father died in 2015. So I was not able to ask him any questions about this book when I finally got the tapes. And what's also interesting is if I had listened to the tapes, like he made tapes, copies for both my brother and my sister, and they listened to them back in 1989. I did not.
Oh, well.
If I had, I probably would have listened to them like they did, thought that's really nice, and put them away and forgotten about them. But what happened is that after teaching, I got out because of the Parkinson's and began first drawing and then doing the writing. And I'd already written three books so that when I got to these tapes, I had the skill sets, the time, and the inclination to write about it where I wouldn't have if I had listened to them in 1989. The timing was right for me to do this book, and I had the skill sets by now to do it.
Well, it sounds like it was definitely meant to be released as a book. Definitely.
Yeah,
that's amazing. And you did mention – oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say that my mother, she's almost – she'll be turning 98 in a few weeks here. And she always wondered, she's like, why did I live so long? And she said, I did for this book because you need, she helped me quite a bit with it the whole time I was working with her. And she said that now she knew why she was meant to have lived this long for me to get this book out.
Oh,
that's wow. Amazing. Yeah, could you describe what her reaction was when she held it in her hands and what she thought of it?
Yeah.
Well, by the time she got the book, well, of course, that was really great, but it was when she first heard the tapes, because she hadn't heard the tapes either. So the two of us, it was COVID, and she was stuck in a nursing facility, and they did let me come in to work with her on these tapes because they thought it was that important. And so we were listening to them, and she was hearing his verse for the first time since he had died. And she hadn't heard some of these stories, and her reactions were quite remarkable. Sometimes she was very happy. Sometimes she was irritated. She'd say, "That's not the way that happened. Here's what really happened. I was there. He wasn't even there when that happened." So I got quite a range of emotions and everything from her, and I was able to fill in a lot of the storyline, lots of things that we were not aware of, by putting them all together. I didn't even know about the letters until she said, I asked her questions. She says, "Well, it's in the letters." I said, "What letters?" She said, "He wrote to me all the time." "What?" Well, turn out my sister had the letters, and she sent me copies of 400 pages of them. And that was only
nice.
The ones that survived. Those were the ones that survived. And he wrote poems. He was very artistic as well. He not only did he write poetry, and some of the selections are in the book. I didn't put too many in, just enough so you could get an idea of how well he wrote and how long involved the some of the letters were. But there were quite a few of those letters, and they really helped fill in the information for me when I finally got all that together.
Well, what a blessing, because I think that was also what a gift to be able to, in a way, visit with your father again. I mean, yeah, his words and experiences and those letters, because those are obviously, you know, intimate, private, you know, letters from him. I mean, so that must have been quite an experience for you to go through them, not just for the book, but also for yourself. That may not have been easy even to go through that, because that's quite a bit, and that's wow. I mean, what a gift you had there.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, well, some of them were really quite remarkable. There were several mysteries that were solved, but the one that was really small one was the night that his mother died. And he described, this is a story that everybody in the family knew. When she died, it was around the 4th of July. It was very hot, and he had gone out onto the porch to sleep. Of course, they didn't have air conditioning or anything like that back then, but he slept on in the corner of the front porch. He just kind of curled up and went to sleep there, and he was about 12, 13 years old, I guess. No, if even that old. And he said what woke him up was this bumping sound, and it was a casket coming out of the house. And it turned out that his mother had died over the night, and he didn't know about it. Nobody had bothered to wake him up.
Oh, man.
Now, that's the story we all knew. So as I'm writing it, I'm saying, this isn't right. This is not right. How could he have slept? Because the casket had to have gone in. That didn't wake him up.
Uh-huh.
There was a hearse out front. There were doctors. There was people. There was all the people caring. Casket. There was all these people were there, and he didn't hear them go in. He just heard them. How could that possibly be? I couldn't. This is driving me nuts. There was another story that we all knew about that occurred at a party when he got hit on the head with this thing called a quoit. It's like a horseshoe, but it's a circle instead of a U shape, and they kind of toss it. They use it like horseshoes. And so they were playing games. They threw it, and it hit him in the head, and he had quite a gap, and his father took him to the doctor and so on. That was supposed to occur during a 4th of July party. But the timing was all wrong for this, and I realized finally that there was a block party for the community for the 4th of July, but the 4th of July fell during weeknight, and back then it was the Depression. People had to work. They couldn't have a party in the middle of the week, so they moved the party to the weekend. And that this party occurred then, and that's and what happened is he got hit on the head at night during the 4th of July, And he had a concussion, and he came out and went to sleep, and that night is when his mother died. And that's why he didn't wake up, because the next morning was when his mother was brought out. And that's why he missed the whole thing. So we put two stories together, and the timing worked out perfectly. So the timing was off, but we couldn't figure that out without having I had a timeline set up, and then I had the letters, and I had information, and then I had my mother to fill in a little bit too, and we solved the whole problem. And the family was really happy because now everything made sense. There was a lot of those going on, a lot of those kinds of things happening as I was writing.
That's good. Yeah, you definitely got to fill in some family history gaps too. Yeah, personal history as well as world history as well occurring in this book. It's really amazing. And his career as a U.S. gymnast. I'd like to hear just a little bit about that. You know, don't have to give out too much about it because I want everybody to read the book. But would like to find out a little bit about how his path went after the war. And, how his career went as a gymnast afterwards.
Well, I'll tell you some things that were not in it, something that was not in the book. And that is exactly that transition, because he ends in 1950 saying that in 1950, my daughter Barbara was born. So ending the violent years. That's how the tape ends. But I had to go further than that, because that ends in 1950. He lived to 2015 and 65 years. And what happened during that. So I have an epilogue for the night that he died. But in between, I talked to my brother and the rest of my family about this quite a bit, about what was happening to him. When he first got to West Virginia, that's where he ended up being the coach. He was the only gymnastics coach that West Virginia University ever had. He was the only one. And he had a choice of going to Yale or to West Virginia, but Yale did not have a coaching position, only a teaching, and he wanted to coach, so he went to West Virginia. And when he got there, he realized that people didn't know about gymnastics. People didn't even know what the word meant. And so what he had to do, like I said, this is not in the book, what he did to build up a program is he had a friend of his named George Nissan, who did trampolines, a multi-million-dollar corporation nowadays, but the two of them went around with a couple of other guys to do demonstrations at every high school in West Virginia during basketball game halftime. They would do a little demonstration to build up interest. And then after a while, the high school started asking West Virginia, hey, do you have any guys that can come down here to be a PE? We need to hire a PE teacher. We need somebody that can do gymnastics. They thought that was really cool. And so he started shipping these guys out all over the state. And then to follow up with that, he started a competition all the way from elementary school to high school. Throughout the state, there was a regular setup every year for competitions in gymnastics. And one year, my brother, when he was in high school, competed in one of these competitions and actually won a couple of events for the state. But he said that while he was there, he was watching, it was men and women, they had girls competing as well, and little kids. There was a little girl, he said she was about 9 years away, and every time she got to compete, she just stood out so much. She just sparkled, is the way that he described her. And he found out her name, he went and asked what her name was, and it turned out it was Mary Lou Retton.
Oh, wow.
That's who the little girl was. Because as you remember, she's from West Virginia. And she came up through my father's program. And he had several programs like that. He started the Special Olympics in West Virginia. That was one of the things that he did. And he had all kind of programs for the university, for the local children in the county would all come to all these programs that he had set up. So he did a lot for the community during his lifetime while he was there at West Virginia.
That's amazing. Yeah, I remember the whole when Mary Lou Retton, came to fame in the United States. And wow, what a cool story. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And what a beautiful thing too when he said in there that your birth was what ended the violent years. I mean, what a beautiful thing you got to receive there. I mean, that had to be a very special thing for you to hear.
Well,
that's such a positive thing.
Right, that's when I knew I had to write it. Right down to that.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's amazing. But yeah, your own path is amazing story as well. From just what I've seen, and I would like to get into that a little bit more because you shifted two entire worlds. I mean, I grew up in a household where my father was a cancer researcher, and my mother was also in cancer research as a lab technician. Both of them loved of course the arts, and my mother and father encouraged me to become follow my heart and become a writer and everything. So I mean, but I grew up in a house that was kind of balanced between science and the arts, and it's interesting that just looking at your bio about how you went from a full career in science to a full career later in the arts, and then the thing that kind of drove that was something really difficult that not everybody can weather that storm so well. I mean, with the Parkinson's disease, I'd love to hear a little bit about your path and how you got into writing, how it kindled, and some of the struggle that you went through in that transition yourself, because your story is inspiring as well.
Well, I was teaching, of course, when the Parkinson's hit, and it was in my right hand, I got tremors. And after a while, I just couldn't write. And typing was terrible because you have tremors, you can't hit the keys, it's a little difficult. And when they got touch screens came in, it was even worse. You touch anything and the full screen changes. So I had to switch to my left hand. That switchover occurred very quickly. I was very easily able to move over on the computer. And I have to use a mouse. I can't just touch because I hit the key repeatedly. And I realized very quickly that I could not only, perform and work on the computer with my left hand, but I could draw using, programs on the computer. I could draw all kinds of things. And I got a lot of pleasure out of being able to do that, so that when I finally had to give up the teaching because the writing was so bad, and I did a lot of work with kids for research. I was helping them with that and grading papers and so on. There's one funny story in there at one point where I was in my office waiting, getting my materials ready to go out into the classroom, and the kids were coming in. This is high school, and they were all getting ready to sit down. And a student came running into my office and very panicked, said, "What did I do wrong? What did I do wrong?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, the note. And he's pointing out into the other room. I went, "What?" And so I got up and I walked out. And, of course, the other students are all now sitting in there all very quiet. And this kid's very upset. And I look at the board, and it has this big note up there. It said, "Fred," or whatever his name was, "Fred, come see me immediately, Dr. Wood." And I looked at the note, and I looked at him, and I said, "Can you read that?" And he said, "Yes." And then I said, "Well, then obviously I didn't write it." And so then he started laughing. Of course, the whole class started laughing. And that just kind of broke a lot of the tensions kids might have had or concern that they might have, with my having Parkinson's at the time. But eventually it got so bad that I did have to stop. And I drew for quite a while, and I do have a lot of my artwork up. I couldn't draw with my right hand very well, but apparently I can with my left, which is interesting. Now, my father was all art as well, but I found out I could draw with my left hand. And so I was very happy doing that until I got this idea for a book one time. I didn't see it as that. I was just the storyline I was thinking, and it was driving me crazy. And I just started organizing in my head, and I finally realized I had to write it down. And then my husband came in one day and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I think I'm writing a book." Until I actually said that, I didn't realize that that's what I was doing.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. Now, as far as I find it fascinating, about the fact that, your right hand, as you said, was your dominant hand, yet you found that you were better drawing with your left. I mean, that's really interesting. Because I wouldn't just think that.
I couldn't draw a circle. Couldn't even draw a circle with my left.
Oh, I know.
So,
I'm the same.
That's amazing.
Well, my neurology, my Parkinson doctor said, like when my brain switched, when I went from right to left-handed, that my brain switched sides, too. It's like everything shifted in me. And when one door closes, another one opens, so they say, and that was definitely my case. And so I haven't had Parkinson's. I've had it for almost 14 years now. And I still play volleyball. I still do lots of fun things. But I still, when I'm sitting at the computer, if I sit at the computer, especially if I'm drawing, I actually have to sit on my right hand. I can't just rest it because it first doesn't rest. And it will invariably migrate up and hit the delete button. I don't know why it does that. You're like, I have to push the hand down. I have to actually sit on it. Otherwise, it'll come up and it'll hit the delete button. And it drives me nuts.
Well,
your right hand is the natural editor. That's the problem.
That's it. It all makes sense.
You're absolutely right. Saying, don't do that, Elizabeth. Oh, that's great. I like that.
But when you type, do you I know that others that have a condition like they make use of today's voice dictation in order to essentially replace typing. Do you use that technology, or do you still do it?
I tried it. I would really like to use it. Yeah. I use it, but I make so many mistakes with that I just end up retyping stuff. There's just too many things going on there with it. But I have tried that. So no, I'm pretty much one finger, left hand, typing four books. I did that way. Painful. Like somebody else will take what someone can write in an hour, be maybe a chapter or two. I get a page in an hour, just tap like that. Pretty sad,
Have you learned the keyboard left-handed though? I'm curious when you're typing, learning to type, you're kind of get to the point where you can type without looking at the keyboard. Now, have you done it after a while? Does your left hand do the same kind of thing? I mean, do you know the keyboard is just left-handed now?
Just kind of left-handed. The right hand will chip in every now and then, but pay attention to make sure it's not hitting the wrong thing.
Delete. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. Well, hey, I mean, you've gotten out four books in the same time that George R. R. Martin has still to get out one, right? So you're doing good.
Sure.
So, but now I would like to shed some light on your early three novels, three novels, are the ones that preceded the current one, The Violent Years. But you have Crypsis, Royal Blue, and The Prism Codex 3. I'd love to hear a little bit about each of those, what they're about, what genres they're in. Tell us about them.
Well, I call them escape thrillers. And in each of the books, somebody is trying to get away. And in each of the books, there's somebody hiding in plain sight. That's what Crypsis means. And I'm going to be actually doing more novels in this line, so it won't be just a trilogy. It'll be a whole series. And I'm going to call it the Crypsis series because Crypsis means hiding in plain sight. That's what the word means. And there's somebody in each of the stories who you don't realize is the bad guy and actually is the bad guy. And in each one, somebody is trying to get away, usually a heroine of some sort that's trying to do something. In the first book that I wrote, I was watching a TV show in which there was a woman who was had a mafia boyfriend, and the police were trapped her into kind of being a spy for the mafia for the detectives. And so she had the boyfriend finds out that she's working, trying to work for the police. So he decides to kill her. She finds out about this. And so she knows he's trying to kill her, and she knows the cops are after her, and she fantasizes about getting away, but she never does. He takes her out in the woods, and he shoots her. This is one episode in this TV show. And that drove me crazy. I thought, why? She knew she had time to get away. Why didn't she do it? And then I started thinking, well, wait a minute. How would she have gotten away? What would she have had to have done to have gotten away from both the police and the mafia at the same time? And that starts me thinking. And then as I thought about it, it got more and more complex. I ended up doing spreadsheets and all kinds of crazy things to keep track of all this. And finally, I said, I have to just write this down. And that's when the book started. And that's what Crypsis is about, is this woman getting away under that circumstance. And then each of the other books, again, it's somebody getting away. And each of the books, there's a woman, and they actually are friends. You don't realize it at the beginning, but the books are all lightly connected in that they know each other. although not all the characters are the same, but there's just a few that are in each of the three books. But like I said, they're escape novels. They're lots of fun, easy read. I left the print fairly large for older people like my mother who would like to read the books.
Right.
Very quick read, lots of fun. They're fun books.
So they are tied together. Okay, because at first I didn't realize that they were tied together in some ways.
Well,
and so it's kind of like a franchise, more or less.
Well, you don't have to. I assume that you're reading
right.
just the one, but there are characters
mm-hmm.
that tie one to the other, but you would not need to
That's
know
fine.
That for the story.
Right. So they're standalone, so you can read any of these
yeah, right.
at any time.
Correct.
And Royal Blue and the Prism Codex 3 are currently out, and you said that you're expanding. So, what are your plans with this? So, you have an idea of how many books there will be, or is kind of open ended right now?
Well, I just know the next one. I've got it pretty well plotted out in my head, and I think I know what I'm going to call it. But I have a bad habit of changing the name at the last minute. So I do have an eye. Violent Years. Violent Years, I knew right away it had to be because my father named it that. But the others
mm-hmm.
Will around a bit. But I do have an idea, and it should probably come out within the next year.
Were you always a reader of thrillers? Is that your the genre you enjoyed growing up, or there? What about you as a reader? Is that where you got the seed for these?
Not particularly. I mean, I do like that, but I read everything. I read all kinds of stuff, fiction, nonfiction, all
mm-hmm.
different kinds of stuff. And for a while there, I only read science stuff. I mean, it was just all science. And I did do writing with science as well. I did do a textbook, and of course, I had my dissertation in the journal articles and those kinds of things. Very different kind of writing, though. It's not creative. The thing I really love about writing that I did not know was going to happen and happened with all three of the fiction books is that the readers then start to dictate how the story is going to go. It's like they're designing the scenes for me, and all I'm doing is watching them and recording what they're doing. And when it's not going right, I'll stop and think about it for a minute. Well, is that the characters don't want to go that way. They're just insisting that they're not going to say what I wanted them to say during that chapter, and I have to rewrite the chapter and think about them and just visualize them and what they're
mm-hmm.
doing and them take over. And the characters actually take over the storyline. I found that absolutely fascinating that other people had that experience, not just me.
Oh, I can relate to you completely in my own work. Yeah, definitely. I also type that, you know, I see it visually and kind of record what I see. And yes, those characters sometimes will rise up and grab you. Sometimes characters you haven't met yet will rise up during the process and demand attention. And that's happened to me more than once. Yeah.
So I
understand.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun doing this. I really have been enjoying the process.
Did you see yourself when you were in the midst of all of your teaching and your science career? Did you ever have the itch at that point? And did you think, okay, later I'm going to get into maybe doing some writing? Or was that not even on the radar during that time? I'm curious about that, too.
Not on the radar until I was actually writing. I had written 30 pages before my husband said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I think I'm writing a book." Until those words actually came out of my mouth, I had no idea that that's what I was about to do. I was just kind of surprised. Like, oh, I am. I'm writing a book. No intention. If you had told me that a year before, I would have said you're crazy.
So how's the response been so far as readers, reviewers, all that good stuff? How folks taken to your novels so far?
Well, so far the stuff that I've gotten are shown up on Amazon, for instance. Not lots and lots of reviews, but the ones I get are very good. Maybe I don't know who all those people are. I know one or two of them, but so I'm hoping that's good. But people seem to like them, I guess. So I haven't heard anything negative. Let's put that way. But just,
well, Well, hey, that's good. There's always a few trolls out there. There's always a few trolls online. You've avoided that.
As their genre that they like. My husband does not care for this book. He likes history. My brother likes to read comedy. So they don't, they'll read them. They go, that's really nice, Barb. But so they're not into it. So I understand that. So there's, but there's always a niche of people mm-hmm. That will gravitate to whatever kind of book that people are writing. And you just have to find them and they have to find you.
That's exactly
that's it.
And I've always said all authors, you know, have to find their readers. Not everyone is going to, you know, not everyone's going to read your work, but your readers are out there, and it's just the task of finding them, which is easier said than done, as we all know as authors, but that's an adventure.
That's why you write for you. You don't write for everybody else. You write for you, and there's people out there that's going to enjoy that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a lot of other books to read out there, too. Lots of fun.
So as far as the publishing route went for your novels and all of them, how did you go approach your publishing side?
Well, at first I tried to go the traditional route, get a literary agent and do all that kind of thing. And I was spending a lot of time doing that with the first book. And then I realized, wait a minute, I really don't care. I'm not in this for the money. I just wanted to have some place to house it. And so I decided to do it independently. And I went through Amazon, and at first I thought it was going to be really hard to do, but after a while I realized, wait a minute, they're making it sound hard. It isn't really that hard to do this. And so I designed all the covers myself, and because of the artwork that I had been doing. And so I just said, well, I'm just going to do it. And if somebody wants to read them, fine. If they don't, fine. That's okay. I'm doing this for me. And I just kept that's how I've been going so far.
That was a question I was going to ask you, was whether you did your own artwork, but that's awesome that you're also able to do that. That is
now
something I can't do. I definitely, unfortunately, I don't have that gift. So,
For the last book, The Violent Years, I did not do the cover for The Violent Years. I hired somebody to do that because I knew what I wanted and I couldn't get it done. I couldn't do it. Where the Crypsis one, I knew exactly what I wanted. I had the skill sets to be able to do that. And the prison, the other covers I did as well. I would like to change one of the others a little bit later, but I'll get to that some other point because I have another vision for that. But the Crypsis one was completely my own, and the Violent Years was not my own.
So what is on the plate next? Is it going to be one of your thrillers? Is that going to be the next work in progress? Or?
I have that. I've had students that have asked me to write my own biography. And at some point I might start some tapes like my father made. So maybe somebody, I always told them, why don't you write my story? Because I didn't see myself as a writer in those years. So maybe I can leave enough breadcrumbs around for somebody to find. So right now, I would really like to write another of the escape thrillers because they're so much fun to write.
Well, I think a memoir from you would be something I would find compelling because, I mean, you have had essentially two careers essentially in two very different spheres, and you know you've had a passion for two different worlds in science and then the arts, and then a lot of people I think could draw inspiration from you coming through the Parkinson's disease and grabbing hold of something and pursuing it. I think that is a really there's a lot in there. I think for definitely would encourage you to think about either as you said leaving a lot of notes for a writer to do that or a memoir from yourself because you've got a story to tell here. Everything I'm hearing tonight.
well, I'll think about it now that you've said that. Maybe I will pursue that a little more strongly. I do have another book I definitely want to write, but I can in the meantime be making notes for a little bit later. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I think I'll do that.
Yeah, I know. I know Holly's I know Holly's thinking that too, because she was listening as well. Because, yeah, I know Holly's definitely. Holly has battled through quietly some of her own health issues, so she can definitely, I think, bond with some of the things that you've talked about and how to get through some things. And and I think it would resonate very strongly.
Well, a lot of parallels. I ended up switching totally too. I was a nurse for over 20 years, that's all I ever done was healthcare. I was a nurse aide for several years, became a nurse, and since I was a child, that's all I ever wanted to do was the medical field. And then I ended up with health issues where I could no longer do that. So I met Stephen, and we ended up together, and I ended up, for whatever reason, it just rings with me. I'm a great convention organizer, so we run a convention, a writing conference, International Film Festival. Mm-hmm. It's a yearly convention in Louisville, Kentucky. We grow every year, and we've grown exponentially the past few years, and very happy about that and what we're becoming. But the Imaginarium, and so I take care of the programming, I do the organizing, it's crazy, but it just resonates with me. And then I'm also an editor, but I was always an avid reader. I did write some, especially poetry and songs. I did do some songwriting back in the day, but I piddled around with that too. So it's very interesting, and we also run the publishing company of Star Press.
Yeah.
So it's quite weird sometimes what fate puts in your lap.
Holly had to switch gears too, and go to a different direction. And the interesting thing is that one of her teachers back in high school always was telling Holly that she needed to go into books. So that's kind of how it worked out eventually.
She's like, Holly, you're not a nurse. You're a literature teacher. You are a literature teacher. And I said, no, I'm going to be a nurse. And no, she said, you need to be a literature teacher.
Yep. So it's kind of strange how that works out.
Laugh. Yeah. Now she can look down and get her last lap in.
Holly can Holly can relate to you on having to switch complete worlds.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to hear about that at some point, and I'd like to hear more about your convention and the work that you guys do at some point, if you could send
we'll
me
hold you and talk to you. Sure.
That. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, if you could ever make it out, we'd love to have you. We'd love to have you out as a guest. I have someone in the chat room asking me, is she going to be a guest at Imaginarium? And I said, well, I will talk to her about it. I would love you to come out and join us. But, it's a pretty big convention now. We're not like a Comic-Con. It's not ran like that.
Yeah.
It is a all-inclusive creative convention. It's writing based.
Yeah.
Stephen always wanted to keep it writing based, but we have game designers because they are writers too. We have musicians that entertain and play. We have an awards banquet and ceremony for book awards. You can enter, if you had a title published this year from January 1st to December
31st.
2023. Yeah, 2023. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can actually enter it for this year's awards.
We'll definitely touch base on that.
We have a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
We have over 125 panels and workshops. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'll send you all the info.
Great. That's nice.
But definitely, because I am loving your story here. And as far as your writing, I mean, obviously you had, with your academic side, I mean, obviously, you had a lot of things that helped you, learn how to write well, especially for the academic settings. But did you ever do any formal creative writing classes, or did you just kind of go into it?
I just kind of jumped in there. There was no background whatsoever in literary areas and writing or help. And so I'm sure I could use a whole bunch of that as well. But right now it was just just doing something fun just appealed to me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, and that is the path a lot of the best authors out there have taken. Absolutely. So I was curious, though, because, yeah, with your academic background, and what was your PhD in exactly? Because I was also interested in that.
Environmental science program development.
Nice, nice.
Wow. I was allowed to develop my own program. It was kind of a cross between education and biology. I wanted to do both. It's almost a double degree in a lot of ways. At least accounting thought it was. I didn't really care. I just wanted to, just finish up the school and move on, so I could move up in my career field in teaching. That's all I was trying to do.
Did you also go to school in West Virginia? Did you go to school, or did you go out of state for that?
Well, I was born and raised and went to college in Morgantown, West Virginia, where the university is and where my father was the gymnastics coach. But then I went to Miami for my master's, and then I lived in Europe for 10 years where both my children were born. And when I came back to Virginia, I went to George Mason University to get the PhD.
Yeah. Nice. So just, very nice.
Yeah. Took a while, but I eventually got there.
That's what
I'm always interested in the academic path because of my, my father and mother, being in that world. I'm always curious about the paths various folks take. Yeah, my dad went from Rutgers to Colorado Springs to Washington University. That was his three stops. So, yeah, I'm always curious.
Yeah. Well, I didn't get the PhD until I was probably around 50. And when I was 45 and I told my friends I was interested in getting it, they said, but you're going to be 50 by the time you get it. And I said, well, I'm going to be 50 anyway. The question is, am I 50 with a degree or 50 without?
So there you
go. Decided 50 with, why not?
Yeah, so absolutely.
So I did.
Well, see, that's the great thing about being a writer or being an academics and all. It's not age limited. Absolutely not. I see people getting their degrees at age 70 and people doing their first novels at age, 75, even 80.
Yep.
I mean, it's wonderful because it's not like sports where you only have a certain window to do your thing.
it's wonderful to
have this kind of world.
You can create until your dying breath, you can keep creating.
That's true.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have a question yes,
from the chat room. Kenzie Michaels was wondering, Barbara, what year your dad was on the Olympic team?
1948, London.
Okay. 1948 in London.
London, right. Right after the war.
Okay. There
you
go.
That was,
I'll let her know.
That was a big year historically in the world. So, yeah, what a year. Yeah.
Yeah, that was an easy. Are there any more questions?
Yep,
that's
we got more in the chat room.
I'm looking. I know some people had to bow out because they got to get up early in the chat room. I'll probably have more earlier.
Most people that we know are having to get up like a half an hour earlier just to warm their cars up with all this cold wave we have.
So a lot of them bowed out because they're like, we have to get up earlier.
Yep, warm the cars up.
There's a lot of comments, on, that's intense. What a fascinating story. They're going to add it to their
list.
To be read.
TBR list.
Amy McCorkle said that it was very fascinating, but she had to bow out a little bit ago. But she said she's going to catch the rest on the replay. She's going to come back and listen to it. Yeah, you could share this too. It will be available for replay about 15, 20 minutes after the show. So people
the stream
that
or download.
Did miss it can come back. Yep. And we do
have
a lot of people that do that. They'll come back later and actually stream.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so they'll come back. So I'm just making sure. I'm checking, too, because I'm making sure I didn't miss any questions. It looks like we're okay. Got a lot of comments, though. A lot of comments that really are enjoying tonight's show. And
Dewan is still on there. Let me see if he's got any questions.
We got
I'll
that.
Ask him.
What areas that we've been talking obviously about the Violent Years, and then we've covered your three books, and we've covered a bit about your path and the transition from science to writing and the arts. Is there any other area that we have not talked with tonight that you would like to speak to us with us about?
I don't know.
Anything that you would like to either projects, personal things, or anything that you would like to highlight while you're with us tonight.
Sure.
We don't want to leave any stone unturned that you would, as far as anything you'd like to cover.
Well, I didn't prepare for that.
It's okay.
No, that's fine. We don't want to put you on the spot.
Oh yeah, we're not putting on you. Yeah, absolutely not.
Well, there's probably lots of little things here and there, but those are the main events, I guess. Growing up, I did not want to be a teacher. I was going to be a flight attendant. That was my big goal in life, my big ambition, which I didn't do, obviously. I did well in school, and the teacher said, "Nope, you're not going to do that. You're too good in science. You need to go another direction." So I was always glad that I had done that. I've had a pretty good life, actually. My father said his life was true, so has my life been.
Oh, it sounds great. I mean, what you've accomplished and continue to accomplish, and I'm excited to see what comes next for you. I mean, definitely a lot in the works here, and I'm excited to check out your thrillers. I mean, obviously, I think The Violent Years is going to be a great read, and I'm definitely looking forward to that and can relate to in a way to hearing those stories about World War II, like my granduncle and what he would talk about, and my grandfather lucked out. He was ended up as an MP on an army base, so he didn't have to get in the midst of it all. I mean, so he got kind of lucky. And then I had a granduncle by marriage in the same group who was on a PT boat in the Pacific. Now he saw some pretty dangerous stuff as well, but my granduncle was the one that had a lot of the fascinating stories. I mean, he even got strafed by an ME-262, one of the first ever jet fighters ever made. Germans made it, and he got called in by Army Intelligence to do a briefing because he happened to be out on a patrol and got strafed by one of these things. They had never seen it before, never seen a plane without propellers. He talked about that. How strange it was, but he really didn't even know exactly what it was until a few years later when he was reading a magazine. It was like, oh yeah, that's exactly what I dealt with. Those stories are just amazing. But I kind of got off on track there. But The Violent Years definitely is on the list. But I also, I'm really intrigued by your thrillers and going to look into those as well. And how, where do you want to direct folks to find those? You mentioned Amazon, but do you also have like a website you'd like to direct people to connect, or social media, any social media handles you'd like to direct people to follow you, connect with you? Links to the books?
Yeah, there's two. Yes. First of all, of the three, Crypsis is the book number one. That's the first book. So you probably might want to start with that one. But they're on Amazon, but there's a catch to finding them on Amazon. If you look up B.B., my author name is B.B. Wood. And if you search for B.B. Wood, and generally at Amazon, it will take you to BBQ Wood, which is barbecue wood and grills and charcoal and that kind of thing. You'll never find me. So you have to go to the book department. In the book department, search for BB Wood, and then The Violent Years or any of the other books that you like. You have an author page, which has links to all four of the books on Amazon, and has more information on them. They have a first chapter of each book is on my author page. It has links to my artwork and my blog up there as well. That page is www.talesfromthewatershed.com. That's all lowercase, all run together. talesfromthewatershed.com. If you just look up Tales from the Watershed, you won't find it. You have to have the www dot in front to get to it.
Gotcha.
and it has a little blurb on it as well.
Yeah, I was able to pull you up pretty quickly by typing B.B. Wood with one of the book titles and putting novel after it on Amazon. Those will come up pretty quick then, actually,
right.
All of
yeah.
them. Countdown Trilogy, you've got them all new numbered, too. Countdown Trilogy, book 1, 2, and 3. And, yeah, I like your covers. And wow, yeah, 4.9 rating so far on book 1. That's all just about a 5-star perfect right there. Congrats. So, yeah, they are liking your book a lot.
Well, I do have a question, though. Mm-hmm. I have a question. And my question is, well, it's a two-parter. The first question I have, who are some of your early influencing writers? I mean, the books that you started reading, you know, that really caught your interest, that, you know, not academic books that you have to read. I'm talking reading for fun. What really caught your interest, you know, at an early age? And then who are some of your favorite authors now?
One set of books of James Michener when I was a kid. I loved James
Michener.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
I read everything. I read, some of his books I read twice. And I can remember as in high school, I was reading one book, and my mother came and yanked the book away from me, and she started yelling at me. And I said, "What?" She said, "You haven't been paying." I had no idea she was there. Wherever I was in that book, I was gone. I was not being rude. I was totally into the story, whatever it was. I now realize you're talking. I like a lot of historical fiction. I like Wilbur Smith. I like Terry Goodkind's series, his fantasy stuff. I read all of those. Anyway, this is what come up off at the top of my head. Some of the books that I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Sword of Truth series is one of my favorites, actually. I love Terry Goodkind's work. Yeah, definitely an amazing writer. And, Michener, you can't get better value. Those are tomes. I mean, those are big books. Those are fun. But you get his books are so amazing. I always loved when I read them, though, just the sense of just history living and breathing in them. And I always felt like, you learn something while you're reading. I mean, it's not just, a great story, but you also get some great edification, you know, from the historical side. Yeah. It's wonderful.
And
yeah, Michener or something else.
Pretty young when I was reading those. And I read the other books. I were reading books together. He'll give me a book and I'll read, you know, some of his stuff as well. So, but now I'm just writing. I read what I wrote.
Yeah. Well, I think it's great to read different genres. I mean, it's great to, and I love hearing the fact that you read James Michener and Terry Goodkind in the same breath, you know, something, you know, like, historical fiction and fantasy. It's great. I mean, because I'm the same way. I read stuff that's very different as well as far as genres go, and I think that helps you become a better writer. I really do. There's different techniques and different lessons that you can learn from each genre of writer who are, you know, of course, masters of their craft. But, you can learn something from all the different genres and types of writers. So, that's great. You obviously have a good foundation there. And now I'm even more excited to read your work. So we have to get into these. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because the early influences always, you know, they obviously do have a hold on you, and so what you produce in your writing, it always shows. It seems to, follow. You can kind of tell a lot about a person by asking them, what books do you read? Who's your favorite authors? You know, and take a deep dive.
Yeah, we got some in the chat room. We do have a follow-up question in the chat room, Barbara. We have Kenzie Michaels does mention that she loves Hawaii and Centennial, both which I think also are great by Michener. But she also she has looked up the 48 team, and she wants to know your dad's name because she's evidently pulled it up on her computer.
Yeah, she's loving this. She's loving the history of this. She is just all in now.
Yeah, his name was William Bonsall, B-O-N-S-A-L-L, and everybody called him Bill, so it's Bill Bonsall. And my full name is Barbara Bonsall Wood. That's why the BB is Barbara Bonsall Wood.
Ah, gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
That all comes from.
Yeah, and I make sure, yeah, when you look up Barbara, look up under B.B. Wood, as she said, and, you know, definitely use the book titles as well when you're looking her up, because, yeah, there is another romance author that also has the same general name. So, yes, it will come up. So, yeah, make sure you use B.B. Wood.
Right, I had to go that route.
Yeah, I have the same problem, Barbara. I can relate. There's a Steven Zimmer. He spells it with a V. I spell it a P-H. He writes westerns, you know, and I don't have any westerns yet. So, I mean, so it's interesting because Google somehow mishmashed our bios. So when you look up just Steven Zimmer author on Google, it somehow blended our bios. So evidently, yeah, it talks about my fantasy work, but it also says I own like a huge acreage in Texas. And so I'm like, hey, show me where this is. Yeah, give me the details on this because I'm not aware. But it happens. So, yeah, I have to sometimes answer questions and people are like, oh, do you have a Western? Do you have some Westerns?
No.
Nope, that's another Steven.
No. Not to be.
But never say never.
Me.
But never say never. Who knows? I might get the itch to write
true.
A Western one day. Then it will be really confusing.
And then you'll
write
a screenplay.
I did. I came close. But,
well, Barbara, have you ever thought about writing just something like a short novella about, you know, something that you haven't wrote before that isn't nonfiction, that isn't?
Yeah,
have you thought about writing
a different genre.
Biological? Or, you know, going to like a biological thriller or, you know, something like that. Have you thought about writing something
with
like that?
With your science background. Yeah, with your science background.
Oh, well, that would be really neat.
One of the Prism Codex is about a computer that's made with DNA, and that actually does exist. But because I taught that for so long, I taught DNA science and I taught AP Bio and all those kind of courses. I employed that in the book, but that book is about a couple that invent this new type of computer that is very high powered, and they want to take over the Bitcoin market because they're Bitcoin miners. And of course, they do invent this new processing unit, and everybody's after them for this unit. And so that's why they're trying to get away. Everybody's after them to get this computer. But I used my science background to make that, to show that was plausible. It actually is plausible to do that, but it's kind of way out there.
Ooh.
But it was fun to throw that in there and throw a little Bitcoin stuff in there while I was doing it. Not too much. You know, I didn't want to get people totally wiped out and all that stuff. So it was just kind of a thing to do.
I'm intrigued already. Yeah.
Yeah,
I love blockchain technology, and I am fascinated with the whole cryptocurrency world. So yeah, that's
well,
definitely
so
interesting.
Like
I love it.
You'll like the Prism Code. Yes.
All right, making my notes. Mark that down, Holly. We got to get that one too.
Our
that's awesome.
Growing.
Yes, our pile of must-gets is growing tonight. But this has been just absolutely wonderful getting to visit with you tonight, Barbara. I'm really glad you spent some time with us because ever since we had put you on the schedule, I mean, Holly has you know, she's the one that first heard about you and really, you know, was telling me, yeah, you really gonna love this guest. And I can say, yes, I absolutely do. And you've been just absolutely wonderful. And I've loved our conversation tonight. So right now, if you just want to give, is there any final thoughts you would like to give? As we kind of wrap this very wonderful show up.
Well, I just want to thank you very much for having me on, and I very much enjoyed talking to both of you and learning a little bit about you as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Well,
and we'll have you back
absolutely
in the future to give us updates and,
yes.
and talk about your next works. And also by that time, hopefully we'll be able to give you our thoughts on more than one or more of your works after we get a chance to read them, and really looking forward to it. And but I'll turn it over to Holly to wrap up with you. And thanks for joining us tonight, Barbara.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, thanks for joining us. And hey, we may be even, you know, kind of coax you out to Imaginarium in July. I might be able to meet you.
Let's cross our fingers. That'd be wonderful.
That'd be awesome. So,
awesome. That's fantastic. Thank you. Oh, we got you. You're still on. But, okay, Holly.
All right. Well, thanks again. And, yes, I will follow up with you. Be looking out for an email. And join us next Wednesday night, listeners, for another great story, another great chat, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And be creative for the rest of the week. And have a good one. Good night, all.
Good night.